Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
The cost of prescription drugs becomes the latest front line in the battle against ever-escalating healthcare expenses.
And, you look at the kind of diabetes patients who use insulin, have seen those prices, skyrocket hundreds of percent over the last, 15, 20 years.
Also this week, a woman's legal guardian seizes and squanders her assets. Elder advocates say this happens a lot more often than you'd think.
You basically are the equivalent of a legal baby, and you have this parent over here who's supposed to make sure that your money is taken care of, your property is taken care of, and your person is taken care of.
We'll also find out what new Florida laws take effect tomorrow and talk with a Florida Public Radio reporter who is checking out the state Supreme Court case involving the Orange County State Attorney this week. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Prescription drug prices are the newest target in the fight over health care costs. Massive price hikes in common medications like EpiPens have raised questions about how prices are determined. Health insurance companies are blaming those costs on rising premiums. And as Lynn Hatter reports, some patients say they're having to ration their prescriptions.
Amber Suggs is married with 5 children. She and her kids have health insurance through a student health plan, but her husband doesn't. He recently lost his state Medicaid coverage, and prescriptions that used to be inexpensive no longer are. Suggs says her husband, Jarrell, has high blood pressure, diabetes, and continues to be treated for heart failure.
His prescriptions, it normally comes up to almost $200, $300.
She now looks for coupons to help lower the cost.
$15 off or 25% off or something like that. The month before that, when we used coupons for it, we got it from $460 to, I think it was like $110.
It's increased, out-of-pocket cost for folks. And you look at the kind of the insulin patients who are, diabetes patients who use insulin, have seen those prices, skyrocket hundreds of percent over the last, 15, 20 years.
Will Holly is the spokesman for the Campaign for Sustainable Drug Pricing. Price hikes are happening not only for new drugs, but for old ones as well.
At the end of the day, these rising prices drive higher insurance premiums. They make it more expensive for businesses to provide insurance to their employees. Job creators have to choose between, paying a rising premium due to higher drug prices or maybe creating a new job.
The campaign is lobbying Congress to pass legislation promoting transparency in pharmaceutical pricing. And the Florida Pharmacy Association's Michael Jackson thinks he knows exactly where to look. Pharmacy benefits managers. Those are the people who negotiate the drug prices, and they work for health plans and decide what medications will be covered and which ones won't.
There needs to be more transparency in that marketplace. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows how the pricing is done. Nobody knows the structure of that environment because it's all behind contracts that no one has access to.
Jackson says those benefit managers are powerful. A choice few employed with some of the nation's largest insurers control most of the prescription drug pricing industry. He also says federal policies regarding how drug makers can consolidate their companies and how certain drugs can be patented impact costs as well. The issue is gaining more attention, but change can't happen soon enough for Amber Stubbs' family. Stubbs says during months when money is tight, she and her husband decide which prescriptions to fill and which to let lapse for the time being.
We mainly focus on his high blood pressure pills because that's what causes fluid to get around his heart and him end up having congestive heart failure. And so, and he's been watching his
diet when it comes to his cholesterol and diabetes so he doesn't have to take those pills.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Next on Capitol Report, a story that's truly sad and unfortunately far too common. A 62-year-old Jefferson County widow is living in a group home after her husband's death led to a nervous breakdown and involuntary confinement. Meanwhile, her former legal guardian is behind bars until she accounts for $400,000 in missing cash, real estate, and personal property. Advocates say it's an example of a faulty system. And as Jim Ash reports, a warning flag for a rapidly aging Sunshine State.
Hi, I'm Dolores Caracci.
Hi, Dolores. I'm Jim Ash.
Hi.
I'm pleased to meet you.
Me too.
A tiny woman with salt and pepper hair and thick glasses, Dolores Caracci is a popular resident at Maxwell House, the nondescript group home where she's lived in rural Jefferson County since 2014. From a dining room table littered with ashtrays, Caracci struggles to describe the psychotic break that forced her to be declared legally incompetent.
Well, my husband died and I had a breakdown. I don't know how to explain it. I lost touch with reality.
Caracci says her oldest daughter, Laura Cooper, came to live with her in Quincy when her husband was dying with cancer. After Caracci was hospitalized, Cooper petitioned a court to become her mother's legal guardian. Caracci says Cooper eventually stopped returning her calls after she went to live in the group home, and she was devastated when she learned her bank accounts were drained, her home was sold, and all her possessions were gone.
The daughter-mother relationship is destroyed.
What would you like to happen now? What are your goals?
Well, what I would like to happen now is to see her go to court for it, be sued for it, and spend time in prison if that's what it takes.
Caracci went to legal aid for help and is now represented by Tallahassee attorney Monique Richardson. Caracci's new guardian and his attorney, elder law specialist Twyla Sketchley, are trying to figure out where all the money went. Caracci is completely powerless and practically penniless. Her only income is a $1,000 monthly Social Security check. Even if Caracci could afford to live on her own, Sketchley says she couldn't sign a lease.
You basically are the equivalent of a legal baby, and you have this parent over here who's supposed to make sure that your money is taken care of, your property is taken care of, and your person is taken care of.
Last week, Circuit Judge Robert Long ordered Caracci's daughter and former guardian held in the Leon County Jail until she accounts for some $400,000 in missing cash, cars, real estate, and other belongings. A legal guardian is supposed to maintain a separate account for the ward, money that goes for housing, food, medicine, and daily living. But Sketchley says the paper trail suggests Cooper went on a spending spree with her mother's money. Sketchley says Caracci's guardian account paid a $1,200 room charge at the Bellagio in Las Vegas and $1,800 to Disney Resorts in Anaheim, California. And the travel expenses don't stop there.
She went on a Pacific Rim vacation using the ward's debit card on the guardianship. You can see her itinerary from Phuket, Thailand, to places in the Philippines, to Kuala Lumpur.
Documents also show the guardian account paid for home improvements, iTunes, and to retire a $20,000 student loan. Florida law has safeguards to prevent guardian abuse, but Sketchley says they didn't work in Caracci's case. She says Cooper didn't file a required Level 2 background check, and she was named guardian even though a court-appointed expert recommended against naming a family member.
Nothing was done when these things weren't filed. You can issue as many orders that say, file this, you've missed your deadline, file this, you've missed your deadline.
Cooper was supposed to inventory her mother's assets when she became guardian, but a court-appointed monitor says Cooper failed to list one of her mother's checking accounts containing $180,000. The monitor says Cooper misled the court about the sale of her mother's home. The monitor also recommended a criminal investigation. Tallahassee Police Department spokesman Dave Northway says his department is conducting one, but he's not allowed to discuss the details.
The timelines in these cases are not something that we can give a specific date or even hour to, due to the fact that all of the facts have to be gathered prior to us deciding to move forward or not move forward with the case.
Cooper has not been charged with a crime. She's being held on civil contempt charges until she accounts for the missing money and property. She could not be reached for comment, and inmates are not allowed to give interviews. But in a May 1st email, Cooper's lawyer, M.B. Adelson, promises the court monitor to turn over financial records as soon as Cooper provides them to him. Adelson wrote, quote, "Every penny of the ward's assets have been properly conserved for the ward's benefit." Adelson did not respond to phone messages requesting an interview. Meanwhile, it's difficult to say how many Floridians become wards of the court or are victimized by their legal guardians.
We've heard a lot of different anecdotes from different areas, but the overall number, how common or it is, our office doesn't have any information on that.
That's Amelia Milton, deputy director of the newly minted Office of Public and Professional Guardians. The department just this week rolled out new guidelines for professional guardians, but it doesn't regulate family members who are appointed guardians. A recent Palm Beach Post investigation showed there were 2,800 open guardianship cases in that county alone last year. The legislature recently beefed up penalties for guardian abuse at the advice of a panel that included Sketchley, the Tallahassee elder law specialist. In the 15 years Sketchley's practiced elder law, she's documented $18 million stolen from clients.
And the vast majority of those cases are never prosecuted. I currently have 4 open litigated exploitation cases in my office right now. This one is the only one law enforcement is contemplating charging someone in.
Sketchley says some people have told her it's not a big deal because children who steal their parents' assets are only stealing their own inheritance. But she says taxpayers end up carrying the burden when the victims are forced to apply for Medicaid and other public assistance. With 10,000 Americans turning 65 every day, Sketchley says the problem isn't going away.
In our current situation where we have these pending huge cuts from Medicaid at the federal level, well, what's going to happen with people like Ms. Karachi? Where are they going to go? And if we don't prosecute the people that do this to them, we as a society have just made it a positive career choice. I can make $200,000 a year stealing from an elderly person with no consequences.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Some good fiscal news for Florida, especially those folks in Florida who take part in the state's retirement system. Florida's $155 billion pension fund seems to be on track to show a positive gain for the 8th straight year as the state's fiscal year drew to a close today. Although the final number won't be out for some time, State Board of Administration officials say they expected the return to be near a Wednesday estimate, showing the fund was up 14.25% for the fiscal year. The anticipated double-digit return for the fund, which pays retirement benefits for state workers, teachers, county employees, and university personnel, will be a much stronger showing than last year when the fund eked out a positive return of just over 0.5%. This year's gain keeps alive a streak that began after a 19% drop in 2009. It's the second longest positive streak in the fund's last 4 decades. The fund, which is one of the largest public retirement systems in the whole country, has earned a positive return in 35 of the last 44 years. In 25 of those years, the return will have exceeded 10%. Still to come on Capitol Report, more than 100 new laws go into effect July 1st, that's tomorrow, including a bill to give students more information about their loans.
What the costs will be, what your loan payments will be, and that works out great because then you can make a sound decision.
Among those 100 new laws, a new comprehensive child welfare law takes effect tomorrow. Supporters say it'll help cut through red tape.
Red tape means unnecessary delays that mean a child can stay too long in a dangerous situation, or that a child lingers in the system instead of being placed in a forever home.
And WMFE reporter Renata Sago joins us after following the Florida Supreme Court's hearing of a case involving the Orange County State Attorney who has ruled out seeking the death penalty.
What is the legal definition for prosecutorial discretion? What exactly are the limits of this term?
This Saturday, more than 100 new laws go into effect in Florida, and we get an update on that from Regan McCarthy.
A new Florida law could be good news for students heading off to college. It requires universities to give kids a better idea of what they're committing to when they take out student loans. Jacksonville Republican Senator Aaron Bean says it's the same kind of information a person gets when taking out a loan for a house.
You were given notice of the cost of that money, the true cost of that money, which is called a truth in lending statement. It's what the government requires lenders to provide you, to what the actual interest rate is, to what the costs will be, what your loan payments will be. And that works out great because then you can make a sound decision.
Under the new rule, students will get information about their loans each school year. Meanwhile, small-scale bakers may need another set of cookie sheets or pie pans. A new law expands the so-called cottage food industry. Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee explains.
These are foods with a very low health safety risk that can be stored at room temperature, including breads, cookies, honey, and all those other fattening things.
Under the provision, a cottage food operator can now earn up to $50,000 through their business and still be able to enjoy certain permitting exemptions. The measure also allows those with a cottage food business to sell their goods over the internet, so long as they're delivered in person. And another new law seeks to protect Florida's newest residents. It expands the medical screening requirements for newborns and gives the Florida Department of Health about a year and a half to adopt new standards. Plantation Democratic Senator Lauren Book is behind the measure.
The Florida Newborn Screening Program currently screens for 31 core conditions and 22 secondary conditions for a total of 53.
Book's legislation would expand that number to include any condition on a federal screening list that's recommended by a group called the Genetics Newborn Screening Advisory Council. Also, pollution reporting will be stepping up under a new law requiring companies to give notice of a spill to the Department of Environmental Protection within 24 hours of discovery. The DEP will then be required to post information about the spill online. Environmentalists are celebrating the move. Susan Glickman says it's important for Floridians to know what's going on.
Let's get the information out in the open and get at the root causes of these problems, because this has an impact on our public health, those of us that live here locally. It also hurts our biggest industry in the state, which is tourism.
Glickman hopes encouraging industries to talk more about pollution will lead to a reduction in the problem. And here's one more law to help out Florida's environment. Sea turtles are getting increased protections under a new rule that gives judges more leeway when assigning a sentence to someone for illegal possession of the animal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Advocates are happy about one of the new laws taking effect. It's slated to help protect kids within Florida's child welfare system, as we hear from Sasha Cordner.
We have a mother who had four children removed. Her son's eye socket had to be rebuilt because she beat him so badly.
That's Victoria Zepp with the Florida Coalition for Children. She says it's unfortunate that there are kids out there who aren't getting the help they need because there are no laws to help them. For example, in the case Zepp gave involving the mother, the four abused kids were able to be removed from the home. But when the community later found out that mother was pregnant with twins, Zepp says they found there was nothing they could do to protect the unborn kids.
The community-based care organization lobbied to ensure that those two children would be party to the case, but they weren't. So that mother, she self-reported that of her twins, she murdered the boy. and put him in a dumpster. We still haven't found that boy because she can't remember because she was too high at the time. That can't happen.
That's why Zepp says she's glad a new child welfare law adds new protections for kids like these. One of its many provisions ensures parents do not get their kids back unless they meet certain conditions.
And if there's a new condition that happens, that's included. Nor if a child has already been removed from a parent and they become pregnant, those unborn children are now protected. Not meaning that we're going to violate anybody's rights, but there's a healthy set of eyes on that parent. But that was huge.
St. John's Republican Representative Cindy Stevenson helped author the new child welfare law. About 100 pages long, she says it also includes a whole host of other provisions.
Almost like a laundry list, but it's a really important list of provisions that will help Department of Children and Families and the judiciary and others involved in the system do their jobs better.
In her mind, Stevenson says this new law will cut through a lot of red tape. For example, she says the new law ensures more timely access to medical records for child protective investigators.
By permitting hospitals and physicians' offices to release patient records to the Department of Children and Family or its contractors for the purposes of conducting an investigation related to cases of abuse, neglect, or exploitation.
Stevenson says it also amends current Florida law for when the rights of parents can be severed.
Under current Florida law, a judge may not consider a parent's previous abuse history from other states when considering whether rights should be terminated. This would enable judges to consider the parent's full history. Crossing a state line does not make a child any safer, and parents shouldn't get a clean slate just because they crossed our state line. This is particularly important for border states like Alabama and Georgia.
Stewart Republican Gail Harrell heads the House committee that oversees children issues, and she also helped write a law to overhaul Florida's child welfare agency years ago. She calls this a next step.
Our committee, the Children, Families, and Seniors Committee, has been working on child abuse issues for the last 5 years. We have been very cautious and sincere in how we have moved forward with the major reforms we're making, and this is the next step.
Meanwhile, the new law also includes provisions for those not in the child welfare system. Those range from addressing needs of homeless youth to creating a task force to address involuntary mental health examinations of Florida kids. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, most days you can find Renata Sago reporting from her home base at WMFE in Orlando. But this week she is in Tallahassee and joins us in our Capitol Report studios. What brings you to the capital city, Renata?
There has been a controversial dispute between the Ninth Circuit State Attorney Aramis Ayala and Governor Rick Scott over the death penalty. Back in March, she announced that she would not be pursuing the death penalty in any case. And so Governor Scott took some cases from her, reassigned them, and she filed a petition before the court to have that reconsidered.
So the Supreme Court of Florida gives this thing a hearing. What went down in the court today?
What went down was a packed house. Every bench was full. And pretty much the justices gave each attorney about 20 minutes each to argue why they thought it was either legal or illegal for Governor Scott to have reassigned those cases. There were many moments when the justices interrupted the attorneys and asked very deep questions about statutes related to how prosecutors across the state exercise their power, whether they can exercise power in charging and sentencing, and whether it's even allowable for a governor to reassign cases without having permission from a prosecutor.
At the point of the hearing today, was there any indication of how the justices might rule? Obviously, this is going to be a while before a ruling comes down, but what did it look like from where you sat?
It looked very fuzzy. Each justice spoke. Each justice asked questions. They scrutinized each side. And so what it sounds like is that this is a serious question about the law, and what is the legal definition for prosecutorial discretion? What exactly are the limits of this term? And did Aramis Ayala operate within the bounds of the Florida statute when she said that she would not be pursuing a certain issue universally?
Regardless of what happens here with the Supreme Court ruling, though, Aramis Ayala and her prosecutorial staff in Orange County will not have the same resources to do their job with come July 1st as they had previous to that date, though, right?
Exactly. Lawmakers voted during the legislative session to cut Ayala's office budget by $1.3 million. And ironically, this is part of Ayala's argument back in March for not pursuing the death penalty. She argued that the money from pursuing death penalty cases could be more responsibly used to combat efforts like domestic violence, human trafficking. And now the office finds itself with 21 positions cut and the $1.3 million cut.
And then finally, depending on how the Supreme Court rules, this could have some far-reaching impact on other jurisdictions across Florida.
Certainly, it really could set a precedent over what exactly the powers are that prosecutors have. And it's really this question of whether a prosecutor can say, I am going to opt out of one specific issue universally. Traditionally, prosecutors might say, hey, I'm going to look at this on a case-by-case basis. But in this instance, Ayala said, for the duration that the statute concerning the death penalty is a bit up in the air, it's been up in the air for the past couple of years, I am just going to refuse to essentially examine cases through the lens of the death penalty sentencing.
And in a totally unrelated situation, the state of Florida is now having to go back and revisit death penalty cases because we have changed the threshold by which juries can actually impose the death penalty during the sentencing phase of trial. So we got all that to look forward to, too.
Yes. And you know what this also has brought up is as more and more gubernatorial candidates present themselves, they're being asked what they think about the death penalty. So this case has really revived an issue about death and sentencing.
An exciting day at the Florida Supreme Court, and from WMFE in Orlando, Renata Sago there to follow the entire thing and share it with us here on Capitol Report. Thanks, Renata.
Thanks for having me.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.